Vegetarians in developed countries avoid this lethal trap because they have access to many foods that are high in both iron and vitamin C, such as broccoli, spinach, and bok choy. Poor people in the developing world are usually less fortunate, however, as those key foods are often precious and strictly seasonal. As if getting enough iron weren't hard enough already, there are several other food molecules that actually interfere with iron absorption, particularly the iron in plants. Foods such as legumes, nuts, and berries, which we're told to eat plenty of, contain polyphenols, which can reduce our ability to extract and absorb iron. Similarly, whole grains, nuts, and seeds are high in phytic acid, which tends to prevent iron from being absorbed by the small intestine. These complications are especially problematic for the 2 billion people on the planet who are at risk of anemia due to poverty, those for whom meat and the iron in it is a rare treat. Their diets tend to be high in the very foods that make iron extraction from plant sources even more difficult. While eating a varied diet is a good strategy to acquire all the elements we need, including iron, it must be carefully varied, in such a way that iron-rich foods are not paired with those that prevent iron extraction. Another dietary component that interferes with iron absorption is calcium, which can reduce iron absorption by up to 60%. Thus, foods rich in calcium, such as dairy, leafy greens, and beans, should be consumed separately from foods rich in iron in order to maximize absorption, especially if the source of the precious iron in question is plant-based. If you go to the trouble of eating iron-rich foods, but pair them with calcium-rich foods, you've negated your efforts. It's not enough to eat the right foods to meet our exacting dietary needs. We must eat those foods in the correct combinations. It's no wonder so many of us opt for a multivitamin instead. Iron deficiency is yet another example of how our species' prehistoric diet was even more insufficient than our modern diet. Although meat and fish were likely staples of the early human diet, their availability waxed and waned, both seasonally and through long periods of feast or famine, and proteins were particularly hard to come by in landlocked communities that relied on meat alone. Before agriculture, the available food plants were nothing like the food people are accustomed to eating now. Fruits were tiny and bland. Vegetables were bitter and mealy. Nuts were hard and tasteless, and grains were tough and fibrous. Worse, plants that reduced iron absorption were more common than plants that provided iron. While it's not all that hard to get enough iron from a vegetarian diet nowadays, it would have been nearly impossible during the Stone Age. Most prehistoric humans would have suffered from severe anemia whenever meat was scarce. This is at least part of the reason why migrations of pre-agricultural human communities largely followed coastlines or other bodies of water. Fish were a more reliable source of iron than meat. You may be wondering how, if anemia is such a lethal and constant danger, humans survived at all. We almost didn't. Our species teetered on the verge of extinction throughout much of prehistory. Over the past 2 million years, several species of hominids have come and gone, with all but one lineage ending in extinction. At certain points in our species' long journey, our ancestors were so few in number that they surely would have been classified as endangered by today's standards. What's more, none of these branches of hominids was more cognitively advanced than any other until very recently. So modern humans can't credit their big brains with surviving each and every brush with extinction. It was probably blind luck that saved our forebears in more than a few instances. These near demises had a variety of causes, but iron deficiency anemia was almost certainly among them. To add insult to injury, humans appear to be unique in the struggle to maintain healthy levels of iron. Neither rampant anemia nor iron deficiency has been documented in any successful species besides ours. How then do other animals deal with the challenge of acquiring sufficient iron? After all, the need for this essential mineral is not uniquely human. and no other animal can produce it either. Surely evolution has devised solutions to this challenge somewhere along the line, even if not in humans. The answer is complicated. First of all, aquatic animals, whether fish, amphibians, birds, mammals, or invertebrates, do not have the same challenge in getting iron because iron ions are plentiful in both seawater and freshwater. These animals still need to extract iron ions from the water, of course, but finding it is a non-issue. Similarly, iron is abundant in rocks and soil, so plants get it easily. It appears that herbivorous or mostly vegetarian animals are either better at incorporating abundant iron sources into their diets or better at extracting it from their food than we are. When these species experience famine, displacement, or other stressors, sure, iron deficiency is common, but that is an effect, not a cause. Humans are the only animals that seem to suffer from iron deficiency, even when they're doing fine otherwise. The frustrating part is that we don't completely understand why it's so hard for us to get enough iron. Why are humans so bad at extracting iron from plant sources? Why are we so sensitive to the inadvertent pairing of iron-rich foods with those that inhibit the ability to extract it? These do seem to be uniquely human problems. It is possible that humans suffered one or more mutations in the genes that are responsible for iron absorption, and it just didn't matter at the time because our ancestors had rich sources of animal-derived iron in their diets, probably fish or big game. That's a plausible hypothesis, although it has not yet been proven. Deficiencies of other heavy metals are much more rare than iron deficiency, mostly because we need so little of these other minerals. We need only the tiniest amounts of copper, zinc, cobalt, nickel, manganese, molybdenum, and a few others. In some cases, we can go for months or years at a time without ingesting those metals, relying solely on our internal reserves. Nevertheless, trace amounts of these heavy metals are crucial, and a diet completely devoid of them would eventually be lethal. Was it an evolutionary error that made it so hard for humans to absorb them? Or was it just a failure to adapt to this challenge? Is there a difference? There are plenty of microorganisms that simply have no need for many of these elements. In fact, there is no single trace metal that is required by all organisms. Put another way, for every one of these elements, there are organisms that have engineered their own molecules to perform those elements' jobs. Humans haven't done much of that, and so we require a broad variety of trace metal ions. Coda, gorged to death. For decades, the United States and other developed countries have been flooded with diet books. This reflects an ominous trend. Starvation used to be a serious threat to all humans. Now, obesity is replacing it as a scourge in many parts of the world. This flows directly from the short-sighted way that evolution programmed our bodies. As many of these books note, we are hardwired for obesity. Yet most popular explanations of how and why things have gone wrong miss the evolutionary lesson at the heart of this growing problem. Virtually every human being loves to eat. Most people are constantly craving food, whether they are really hungry or not. And cravings are usually for high-fat, high-sugar foods. But most of the foods that supply essential vitamins and minerals, from fruits to fish to leafy greens, are not high in sugar or fat. When was the last time you had an intense craving for broccoli? So why do our instincts drive us to high-calorie foods, no matter how well-fed we are? Because obesity has been on a steep and steady rise and was not a major health concern until the past century or two, it is tempting to consider it a problem of modernity, not biology. But while it's true that modern lifestyles and eating habits are to blame for the current rate of obesity in the developed world, that is putting the cart before the horse. People don't eat too much just because they can. They eat too much because they were designed to. The question is, why? Humans are not unique in being gluttonous. If you have dogs or cats, you have undoubtedly noticed that their appetites seem to be insatiable. They always want more treats, more scraps, more food, and they will beg more persistently for rich and savory foods than for, say, salad. In fact, our companion animals are just as prone to obesity as we are. If we are not careful about how much food we give them, they will become overweight quickly. Scientists know that this is true for laboratory animals as well. Whether they are fish, frogs, mice, rats, monkeys, or rabbits, their food has to be limited, or they will become overweight. The same is true at zoos. Animal handlers and veterinarians constantly monitor the weight and food rations of the captive animals so their health won't suffer due to overconsumption. The take-home point here is that all animals, including, and especially humans, will become morbidly obese if left purely to their own devices. This is in direct contrast to what we see with animals in the wild, where obesity is rare, to say the least. Animals living in their natural habitats are almost always tight and trim, skinny even. It was once thought that the artificial environments of zoos, laboratories, and human homes were to blame for animals' obesity. After all, animals have spent millions of years adapting to their wild natural habitats, and the artificial ones are just no substitute. Perhaps the stress of captivity causes nervous overeating, or maybe the comparatively sedentary lifestyle throws the metabolic dynamics out of balance. While these are reasonable hypotheses, they've been tested over the years and don't seem to be the main explanations for captive animals' obesity. Captive animals that exercise still need their food rationed. They will still become obese if they're provided with too much. So why don't we find obese animals in the wild? The answer, a rather disturbing one, is that most wild animals are teetering on the edge of starvation pretty much all the time. They live their lives in a state of constant hunger. Even animals that hibernate and spend half the year binging are still relentlessly hungry. Surviving in the wild is a brutal business and a perpetual struggle. Different species of animals are in constant competition with one another for scarce resources, and there is simply never enough food. This scarcity of food is a biological constant for all animals, except modern humans. For much of the 20th century, it was thought that modern lifestyles and conveniences were to blame for the emergence of obesity. Desk jobs had begun to replace manual labor, and radio and television were replacing sports and other forms of physical recreation. The thinking was that previous generations had been much more physically active in both their livelihoods and their entertainment. The increasingly sedentary lifestyle and the transition away from physical toil was to blame for bulging waistlines. By this reasoning, obesity is not the result of a design flaw, it's the result of poor lifestyle. Although this may seem to make sense, it is not the whole story. For one thing, people who do make their living through physical toil are not in any way immune from obesity. The opposite is true, in fact, as both obesity and physical labor correlate with lower income. Second, children who spend more time engaging in physical play than indoor play are no less likely to develop obesity as adults. Again, the opposite tends to be true. People who are active athletes throughout their childhood, adolescence, and even into adulthood are more likely to be obese in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, particularly when their physical activity wanes. It isn't lifestyle. It's the overconsumption of calorie-rich foods that seems to be the main cause of obesity. This explains why, unfortunately, exercise alone rarely leads to long-term weight loss. In fact, exercise may do more harm than good. Intense exercise leads to intense hunger, which in turn leads to poor diet choices and chips away at the mental resolve to lose weight. Each time someone slips on a diet, he gets closer to just giving up altogether. The hard truth is that humans in the developed world are surrounded with high-calorie foods that they are ill-equipped to resist. For most of our species' history, this just hasn't been something anyone needed to worry about. Until the past couple of hundred years, most people didn't have access to diets rich in meat and sweets. It was the Industrial Revolution that began to bring rich diets to the masses. Before that, stoutness in a man and plumpness in a woman were signs of wealth, power, and privilege, and the commoners were, like animals in the wild, prone to constant hunger. Overeating was a fine strategy when it wasn't possible to do very often. But when people can pack it in three or four times a day, day after day, their feeble willpower doesn't stand a chance of moderating intake to prevent unhealthy weight gain. Human psychology is no match for human physiology. This is why people too often treat every meal as if it were the last one before a long winter, as if they're gorging themselves in anticipation of barely being able to find any food at all. It gets worse. As recent studies have shown, our bodies adjust our metabolic rates so we gain weight easily and lose weight only with difficulty. Those who have struggled with their weight will tell you that weeks of dieting and exercise often result in negligible weight loss, while a weekend calorie binge can pile on a few pounds almost instantly. Thus, obesity and type 2 diabetes are the quintessential evolutionary mismatch diseases, conditions that directly result from humans living in a very different environment than the one they evolved in. I highly recommend Dan Lieberman's book, The Story of the Human Body, which explains at great length the many ways in which the mismatch between our current environment and our former one leads to illness and disease. Thanks to modern food supplies, people in the developed world will probably never need to worry about scurvy, beriberi, rickets, or pellagra. Obesity, however, will be a constant challenge to their willpower and habits. There is no quick fix. This fatalistic truth is reminiscent of the next categories of flaws we will explore, the flaws in our genomes. 3. Junk in the genome. Why humans have almost as many broken, non-functional genes as functioning ones, why our DNA contains millions of virus carcasses from past infections, why a bizarre self-copying piece of DNA makes up over 10% of the genome, and more. You may have heard that humans use only 10% of their brains. This is a total myth. Humans use every lobe, fold, and nook of their neural tissues. While some regions specialize in certain functions, speech for instance, or movement, and rev up their activity when performing them, the whole brain is active pretty much all of the time. There is no part of the brain, no matter how tiny, that can be deactivated or removed without serious consequences. Human DNA, however, is a different case altogether. There are vast expanses of our genomes, the entirety of the DNA we carry in each of our cells, that do not have any detectable function. This unused genetic material was once referred to as junk DNA, to reflect its presumed uselessness, although this term has fallen out of favor with some scientists, as they have discovered functions for some parts of this junk. Indeed, it may very well turn out that a large portion of so-called junk DNA actually serves some purpose. Regardless of how much junk our genomes contain, however, it is undeniable that we all carry around a whole lot of non-functional DNA. This chapter tells the story of that true genetic junk. The broken genes, viral byproducts, pointless copies, and worthless code that clutter our cells. Before we proceed, it is worth pausing for a quick refresher about the basics of human genetics. Almost every one of your cells, whether it's a skin cell, a muscle cell, a neuron, or any other type of cell, has within it a core structure called a nucleus that contains a copy of your entire genetic blueprint. This blueprint, much of which is illegible, as we'll see, is your genome, and it is composed of a type of molecule called deoxyribonucleic acid, better known as DNA. DNA is a linear double molecule that looks like a very long twisted ladder, and the genetic information it contains is written in pairings of other, smaller molecules called nucleotides. Think of these nucleotide pairs as the rungs of this metaphorical ladder. Every rung has two halves, each of which is a nucleotide molecule that's attached to one of the two sides of the ladder. These nucleotides come in four flavors, abbreviated A, C, G, and T. A can pair only with T, and C can pair only with G. These are known as base pairs, and they are what make DNA such an incredibly effective carrier of genetic information. If you look along one side of the ladder that is your DNA, you can see any combination of the four nucleotide letters. Let's say you are looking at five rungs, and on one side you see the letters A, C, G, A, and T. Because the rung pairs can only put A with T and C with G, you can be confident that if you moved around to the opposite side of the ladder and looked at the other half of these same rungs, you would see a mirror image of the code on the other side, with the sequence reversed. A, T, C, G, and T. This is a simple but ingenious form of information coding, especially because it makes it very easy for genetic material to be copied again and again. After all, you could rip your entire massively long ladder down the middle, splitting every rung in half, and each half would essentially contain the same information. This is precisely what the cell does in order to copy the DNA molecule prior to cell division, the basic process by which the body replaces old cells with new ones. So DNA's ability to copy itself is not only a miraculous feat of evolutionary engineering, but also the basis of our very existence. So far, so good. DNA is a wonder of nature. But here's where it starts to look less wondrous. The ladder of DNA that makes up your genome has billions of rungs, 2.3 billion in total, composed of 4.6 billion letters. And a lot of those rungs are, for lack of a better word, unusable. Some of them are pure, repetitive nonsense, like someone was pounding on a computer keyboard for hours, while other bits were formerly useful but became damaged and were never repaired. If you read along the entirety of either side of the ladder of your DNA, you'd notice something strange. Your genes, those sections of the code that can actually accomplish something, cause the irises of your eyes to take on a certain color, say, or direct you to develop a nervous system, are only about 9,000 letters long on average, and you have only around 23,000 of these genes in total. That might seem like a lot, but in truth it's only a few hundred million letters of DNA, a couple hundred million rungs, out of the 2.3 billion that make up your body's genome. What are all those other rungs doing if they're not part of your genes? The short answer is, nothing. To understand how this could be, let's adopt a new analogy. Let's call genes words, a string of letters of DNA that add up to something meaningful. In the book that is your genome, the spaces between these words are filled with incredibly long stretches of gibberish. All told, only 3% of the letters in your DNA are part of words. Most of the remaining 97% is gobbledygook. You don't have just one long ladder of DNA. Each cell has 46 of them, called chromosomes, and they can actually be seen under a regular microscope in the moments that a cell is dividing. The exceptions are sperm and egg cells, which have only 23 chromosomes each. When cells aren't dividing, however, all of the chromosomes are relaxed and mushed in together like a big bowl of 46 tangled spaghetti noodles. The chromosomes vary in length, from chromosome 1, with 250 million of these rungs, to chromosome 21, with just 48 million rungs. While some chromosomes exhibit a fairly high ratio of useful DNA to junk, others are littered with repetitive, unused DNA. For example, chromosome 19 is fairly compact, with over 1,400 genes spread over 59 million letters. On the other extreme is chromosome 4, which is 3 times larger than 19, but has around half the number of genes. These functional genes are few and far between, like small islands surrounded by vast, empty oceans. In this regard, the human genome mirrors that of other mammals, and all mammals have around the same number of genes, roughly 23,000. Although some mammals have as few as 20,000, and others have as many as 25,000, this is still a relatively tight range, and one that is particularly surprising, given that the mammalian lineage is more than 250 million years old. It is quite remarkable that, even though humans have been evolving separately from some mammals for over a quarter of a billion years, we all have a similar number of functional genes. In fact, humans have roughly the same number of genes as microscopic roundworms, which have no real tissues or organs. Just saying. While relatively sparse, operational genes do a lot of work. They each make proteins by ripping the DNA molecule's ladder down the middle and exposing all the letter nucleotides of either side. The stretch of letters that make a gene can be copied into something called mRNA, M for messenger, and RNA for ribonucleic acid, which in turn makes a protein that can travel around cells and help everything happen, things like growing and staying alive. These 23,000 genes that collectively make up 3% of the genome are a wonder of nature. Most of the other 97% of human DNA is more of a blunder. It does not seem to do very much. Some of it, indeed, is actually harmful. The entire genome, functional or not, gets copied every time a cell divides. This consumes cellular energy and requires time, energy, and chemical resources. The best estimates are that a human body experiences at least 1 times 10 to the 11th power cell divisions each day. That's over a million cell divisions per second. Each one of those divisions involves copying the entire genome, junk and all. You expend a few dietary calories every single day just to copy your largely useless DNA. Oddly, cells meticulously spot-check this junk DNA for errors. Each time a cell copies this irrelevant DNA, it engages the same proofreading and repair mechanisms that it does when it copies the most important genes in the genome. No region is ignored. None gets special attention. This is perplexing because a replication error in a stretch of gibberish DNA is inconsequential, while the same mutation in a gene can be lethal, as we'll see shortly. The machinery for copying and editing DNA can't seem to differentiate between the two types, genes and gibberish, any more than a chimpanzee can differentiate between a poem by a preschooler and one by Maya Angelou. We are in an exciting new era of biomedical research. Scientists can now read the entire sequence of someone's genome, all 4.6 billion letters spread across the 46 chromosomes, in a process that takes just a couple of weeks and costs about $1,000. The first complete sequencing of a human genome took over a decade to finish and cost nearly $300 million. But although we are finding many surprising new functions for some regions of DNA, formerly referred to as junk, these are still overshadowed by the non-functional junk. What's more, even the apparently functional junk probably began as pure junk. In 2012, the massive genome exploring project called ENCODE made a big splash by claiming that up to 80% of the human genome was functional. This claim has been soundly refuted, owing partially to methodological concerns, but mostly to researchers' unscientific criteria for declaring a part of the genome functional. This has led many scientists to revisit and defend the use of the term junk to describe non-functional DNA. See Grauer et al. On the Immortality of Television Sets, Genome Biology and Evolution 5, 2013, pages 578 to 90, for an excellent explanation of the flawed reasoning of the ENCODE claims. Given all of the nonsense encoded in the human genome, it's amazing we've turned out as well as we have. Although the enormous tangled masses of useless DNA in the genome may be the biggest flaw of all, even the functional parts of it, the genes, are rife with errors. These errors generally come from mutations, which are what we call the changes that get made to a DNA sequence. There are two common ways that the genome can experience sudden changes. Three, if you count retroviral infections, but we'll talk about those soon enough. One is through damage to the DNA molecule itself. This can occur due to radiation, UV light, or harmful chemicals called mutagens, such as those abundant in cigarette smoke. Mutagens are often called carcinogens, due to the mutation's tendency to cause cancer. A second way that the genome can experience changes is through copying errors made when DNA is duplicated in preparation for cell division. Each cell has 4.6 billion letters of DNA code, and each day the average person experiences somewhere around 1 times 10 to the 11th power cell divisions. So that is literally 10 to the 20th power, or 100 quintillion chances a day, for a cell to make a mistake while copying DNA. Cells are terrific copy editors, making fewer than one mistake in a million letters and immediately catching and correcting 99.9% of those rare errors. But even with that incredibly low error rate, with so many chances to make a mistake, sometimes mistakes do happen and don't get corrected. Those become mutations. In fact, every day you experience millions of mutations throughout your body. Fortunately, most of those mutations occur in unimportant regions of the DNA, so they don't really matter. Further mutations in cells that are not sperm or egg cells have no real consequences for evolution because they don't get passed on. Only the DNA in the so-called germ cells contributes to the next generation. However, both copying errors and DNA damage can and do occur in important regions of the genome of sperm or egg cells. When this happens, these mutations will probably not affect that individual so much as his or her children. These are thus called heritable mutations, and are the basis of all the evolutionary changes and adaptations in living things. But it's not all happy accidents when it comes to heritable mutations. While most are inconsequential, considering how much of the genome doesn't do anything anyway, many mutations are harmful because they disrupt the function of a gene. The poor offspring that inherit a gene mutation from their father or mother are almost always worse off for it. That's what natural selection is all about, keeping the gene pool clean. But sometimes the harm that a mutation brings is not immediate. If a mutation causes a human or animal no short-term loss in health or fertility, it won't necessarily be eliminated. It could even spread throughout the population. If this mutation causes harm only far down the road, natural selection is powerless to immediately stop it. This is evolution's blind spot, and its ramifications can be seen throughout our species, and deep inside each of us. For the human genome contains thousands of scars from harmful mutations that natural selection failed to notice until it was too late. Broken genes. Of the useless DNA in the human genome, one particular kind stands out, pseudogenes. These stretches of genetic code look like genes, but do not function as such. They are the evolutionary remnants of once functional genes that became mutated beyond repair at some point in our species' deep past. We saw one such pseudogene in the previous chapter, the Gulo pseudogene, which in its functional form allows nearly all non-primate animals to synthesize their own vitamin C. In some common ancestor of all living primates, the Gulo gene was damaged by random mutation. Because this ancestor happened to have a diet rich in vitamin C, the mutation didn't cause any harm to that individual. However, since it was passed on to all primates, they, We are subject to the horrors of scurvy. You might wonder why nature wasn't able to fix this problem the same way it created it, through mutation. That'd be nice, but it's nearly impossible. A mutation is like a lightning strike, a random error in the process of copying 4.6 billion letters of DNA. The odds of lightning striking the same place twice are so infinitesimally tiny as to be non-existent. What's more, it's exceedingly unlikely that a mutation will fix a broken gene because, following the initial damaging mutation, the gene will soon rack up additional mutations. If the first mutation doesn't kill or harm the bearer, future mutations won't either. These mutations will not be eliminated by natural selection. This is why, over the scale of evolutionary time, the mutation rate of pseudogenes is dramatically higher than that of functional genes. Mutations in functional genes don't usually persist across generations. Typically, the lightning strike will cause such harm to the cell or organism in which it occurs that the individual will be less likely to reproduce successfully, thereby limiting the spread of the faulty genetic material. Pseudogenes, however, are free to accumulate mutations without harming the entity that carries them. And that's exactly what happens. The pseudogenes get passed on and on, continuing their deterioration down through the generations, and it doesn't take long before the gene is mutated beyond all hope of repair. That's what happened to the human Gulo gene. Compared to the functional version that most other animals have, our Gulo gene is littered with hundreds of mutations, yet it is still easily recognizable. Our Gulo gene is more than 85% identical to the DNA sequence of the functional Gulo gene found in carnivores, such as dogs and cats. It's mostly all there, just sitting, useless, like a car rusting in a junkyard. Except that humans have continually refashioned this rusty old gene, billions of times every day, ever since the gene was initially broken tens of millions of years ago. Thanks to scurvy, Gulo may be humans' most famous pseudogene, but it is hardly the only one. We humans have quite a few broken genes lurking in our genomes. Actually, well over a few. More than 100, or even 1,000. Scientists estimate that the human genome contains the intact remnants of nearly 20,000 pseudogenes. That's almost as many broken genes as functional ones. To be fair, the majority of these pseudogenes are the result of accidental gene duplications. This explains why the disrupting mutations and subsequent death of the gene didn't have any deleterious effects on the individual. These were extra copies of genes anyway. Their function was redundant with that of other genes, so losing these genes didn't put anyone at a disadvantage. Of course, it's still pointless to keep them around and duplicate them constantly. Pointless and a waste of energy, but not directly harmful. But when the only copy of this or that functional gene gets broken by a mutation and becomes a pseudogene, it can really hurt. Besides Gulo and its gift of scurvy, another pseudogene whose breakage had a deleterious impact on our species' health is a gene that once helped our ancestors fight infections. This gene created thetadefensin, a protein still found in most Old World monkeys, New World monkeys, and even one of our fellow apes, the orangutan. However, in an ancestor common to humans and our African ape relatives, gorillas and chimpanzees, it was deactivated, then mutated beyond repair. Without a working version of it, humans are more susceptible to infections than our more distant primate cousins. Admittedly, we have probably evolved other defenses to take the place of these thetadefensin proteins, but not enough, it seems. For instance, cells that lack theta proteins appear more susceptible to HIV infection. We really could have used these proteins in the late 1970s and 1980s as HIV ravaged human populations around the globe. Were it not for this broken gene, the AIDS crisis might never have happened. Or at least it might not have been so widespread and so deadly. Pseudogenes are a lesson in the cruel habits of nature, which takes no thought for the morrow. Mutations are random, and natural selection operates merely from one generation to the next. Evolution, however, operates on very long timescales. We are the long-term products of short-term actions. Evolution is not, indeed cannot be, goal-oriented. Natural selection is affected only by immediate or very short-term consequences. It is blind to long-term ones. When Gulo, or the gene that produces theta-defensin, die by mutation, natural selection can protect the species only if the lethal effects are felt immediately. If the bearers of the mutation continue to flourish and pass it down to their progeny, evolution is powerless to stop it. The death of the Gulo gene probably had no consequence at all for the first primate that endured it. Yet, his or her distant progeny suffers still, several tens of millions of years later. The Gulo gene and the theta defensin gene are not unique in having suffered such debilitating mutations. Every single one of our other 23,000 genes has been, and still is being, struck and killed by the lightning bolts of mutation. The only reason humans haven't lost more genes to mutation is that the first unlucky mutant usually dies, or is made sterile, and is thus not able to pass on the pseudogene. A tragic fate for her or him, but lucky for the rest of us. Some scientists refer to pseudogenes as dead, rather than broken, because nature has managed to resurrect some of them to serve new functions. This reminds me of something a friend of mine once did when his refrigerator broke. Instead of undertaking the hassle of hauling it to a junkyard, he turned it into an armoire for his bedroom. He didn't buy a refrigerator, intending to turn it into an armoire. He just repurposed a broken fridge as one, because it was much easier than getting rid of it. He resurrected his dead refrigerator for a brand new purpose. It was a nifty trick, but as far as we know, resurrected genes are as rare as armoire refrigerators. Alligators in the gene pool. As we've just seen, the process of copying DNA is not perfect. The machinery that our bodies have developed for this purpose occasionally makes mistakes, and these mistakes can cause problems. But those kinds of mutations are sporadic, freak accidents like the sudden death of the Gulo gene in one primate's genome, which just so happened to spread to an entire population of organisms. Like the mutations themselves, the diseases that sometimes result from these errors, such as scurvy, are sporadic. But there is an entire class of genetic diseases that are more insidious than these, precisely because the mutations that caused them weren't fixed by the accident of genetic drift. They were actually favored by natural selection. Humans have a whole host of persistent genetic diseases that have been with our species for generations, millennia, even millions of years. Each of them has an interesting story, and collectively they can teach us some valuable lessons about the sloppy and sometimes cruel process of evolution. Probably the most well-known and widespread example of a genetic disease that has frustrated humans for ages is sickle cell disease, or SCD. 300,000 babies are born with this condition every year. In 2013 alone, at least 176,000 people died from it. The disease is caused by a mutation in one of the genes for hemoglobin, the protein that carries oxygen around in the bloodstream and delivers it to all cells. Normally, red blood cells are packed with hemoglobin and take on a shape that facilitates both maximum oxygen delivery and optimal folding, so that the cells can squeeze through tiny blood vessels called capillaries. The mutant versions of hemoglobin found in SCD patients, however, do not pack together as tightly, resulting in poorly shaped red blood cells. These malformed cells do not deliver oxygen as efficiently, and worse, cannot fold and squeeze through small vessels. They tend to get stuck in tight spaces, creating a sort of sanguinary traffic jam that leads to an intensely painful and sometimes life-threatening sickle cell crisis as the tissue downstream of the traffic jam becomes starved for oxygen. In the developed world, the danger of sickle cell crises can usually be managed with close monitoring and modern medicine. In underdeveloped regions of Africa, Latin America, India, Arabia, Southeast Asia, and Oceania, It is often fatal. The strangest aspect of SCD is that it is caused by a single point mutation, a simple switch of one DNA letter for another. Though there are many possible point mutations that can cause the disease, with different mutations common to different geographical ethnic groups. This is truly strange because a point mutation with such a drastic negative effect on survival is usually eliminated from the population rather quickly. Research in population genetics has shown convincingly that a mutation that causes even a slight disadvantage will be eliminated from a population in a matter of a few generations, not thousands of years. To be sure, genetic diseases caused by the interaction of multiple genes, or those that give only a slight predisposition toward illness, are sometimes difficult for natural selection to sort out. But SCD should be easy. It's a single mutated gene with a disastrous effect. There is simply no way that it should have persisted for very long. Yet the mutant coding that causes SCD is hundreds of thousands of years old, and it has appeared and spread in many different ethnic groups. How could a mutation that causes a horrific, debilitating disease, one that can easily be fatal without modern medical intervention, not only pop up multiple times and in multiple places throughout human history, but also appear to often have been favored by natural selection? Further, how could it have spread so relatively far in the populations it affects? The answer is surprisingly simple. Like many genetic diseases, sickle cell disease is recessive. This means that you need to inherit two copies of the mutant allele, one from each parent, in order to develop the disease. If you inherit only one copy, you will not be affected in any noticeable way, although you will be a carrier, able to pass the gene to your children, and they may develop the disease if the other parent also gives them a bad copy. If two carriers of SCD procreate, approximately one-fourth of their children will develop the disease, even though both parents appear to be healthy. For this reason, recessive traits sometimes give the appearance of skipping generations. Nonetheless, with SCD being so deadly, the early deaths of the sufferers of the disease should have eventually eliminated it from the population. The reason the SCD mutations were not eliminated is that the carriers of SCD, the individuals who have only one copy of the code and are thus not afflicted with the symptoms, are more resistant to malaria than non-carriers. Malaria, like SCD, is a disease affecting red blood cells. However, malaria is caused by a parasite that is passed to humans through mosquito bites. It turns out that people with just one copy of the mutant SCD allele do have a slight difference in the shape of their red blood cells. It's not enough to cause the sickle cell disease, but it is enough to make the cells inhospitable to the parasite that causes malaria. Sickle cell disease is often discussed in introductory biology courses as an example of something called heterozygote advantage. Heterozygote being the term for someone who has two different copies of a certain type of allele. A carrier of SCD is a heterozygote for the affected gene because she has one copy of the mutant allele and one normal copy. To see why being a carrier could be an advantage, first consider the fact that if you get two copies of the mutant SCD allele, you are in serious trouble. However, if you get just one copy, you are better off than those who have no copies, because you're both SCD symptom-free and you have a lower chance of contracting malaria. In areas of the world where malaria is and has been a real problem, the mutant SCD gene is being pulled in two directions by natural selection. On the one hand, sickle cell disease can be deadly. On the other hand, malaria can also be deadly. Evolution had to weigh one threat against the other, and the result is a compromise in which the mutant alleles that cause SCD but protect against malaria are present in up to 20% of the population in the most malaria-infested regions of Central Africa. Quite predictably, sickle cell disease is not distributed evenly across human populations. After all, an SCD mutation that appeared in an individual living in a region relatively free of mosquitoes and malaria, say, Northern Europe, would confer no advantage on that individual. The allele would simply be a disease-causing mutation and would thus not persist. For this reason, sickle cell disease is almost unheard of in European populations. In fact, the geographic prevalence of sickle cell disease overlaps amazingly well with the geographic prevalence of malaria. There's an interesting final twist in the story of sickle cell disease. Researchers understood the push-pull of evolutionary pressure on the mutant code, but they initially could not understand why SCD persisted, because sickle cell disease is so much more deadly than malaria. They built computer models that predicted the opposite. SCD should have died out, but they overlooked a crucial factor stemming from the fact that many pre-agricultural human societies engaged in polygamy. In most polygamous societies, a minority of men have multiple wives, meaning that males directly compete with one another for the privilege of reproducing with as many females as possible, with most males not reproducing at all. Among males, competition is quite fierce, and there is a direct and strong relationship between the number of offspring one leaves and one's overall health, vitality, and virility. In this scenario, the push-pull of malaria versus sickle cell disease would likely doom males that had either two copies or no copies of the SCD alleles. These males would be either afflicted by sickle cell disease or vulnerable to the ravages of malaria. Most of the dominant and prolific males would thus be carriers. These alpha males, to borrow a loaded term, would reproduce with a large number of females and produce an even larger number of offspring. Many of those offspring wouldn't make it to adulthood because, in addition to having the normal afflictions, infections, and deficiencies of pre-modern life, many of them would also have to contend with either malaria or sickle cell disease. That would have been perfectly okay, however, because the SCD carrier and his harem would constantly produce more babies. Compared to binary marriage, polygamy substantially intensifies the selective pressures of health and survival because of the direct competition of males with one another. The heterozygote advantage is even stronger because a male must be in tip-top shape in order to fend off other males and earn a harem. Any predilection toward SCD or sensitivity to malaria would be a weakness he could ill afford. Although polygamy was never a universal human practice, it was common enough in certain places at certain times to facilitate the proliferation of the gene mutations that cause sickle cell disease. Many people whose ancestry traces to malaria-infested tropical regions still suffer from this genetic malady. Other single-gene genetic disorders include cystic fibrosis, various forms of hemophilia, Tay-Sachs disease, phenylketonuria, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and hundreds more. These genes are recessive, like the gene for SCD, so you must inherit the mutation from both parents in order to be afflicted. This makes each of these diseases fairly rare. However, collectively, genetic diseases are not uncommon. Some estimates suggest that genetic disease affects around 5% of the human population. While not all of them will be lethal or even debilitating, we are still talking about hundreds of millions of people walking around our planet with errors in their genetic code. Most of those errors occurred generations ago, and many of the people who carry those errors don't even know it because they are heterozygote carriers. Those who do suffer are the result of an incredibly unlucky pairing of two unknowing carriers. A few genetic diseases are caused by a dominant mutation rather than a recessive one. This means that, instead of having to inherit a bad gene from each parent, just one from either parent is enough to cause the disease. These are much rarer for the obvious reason that they aren't ever hidden. The selective pressure against a genetically dominant disease mutation is usually swift and unforgiving. However, a few of these mutations have persisted across generations, as have the genetic diseases they cause. For example, Marfan syndrome, familial hypercholesterolemia, neurofibromatosis type 1, and achondroplasia, the most common form of dwarfism. These conditions are often inherited from a parent, but even when the mutation occurs spontaneously in an individual with no family history of it, which actually happens quite often, the resulting disease will be passed on to 50% of that person's offspring. Sadly, therefore, genetic diseases are just as persistent in the lineages of people who developed the mutation sporadically as they are in the lineages of individuals who inherited their condition from one of their parents. Among the most well-known genetically dominant diseases is Huntington's, an especially cruel disease. Symptoms don't usually appear until the victim is in his or her early 40s to late 50s. Following the onset of the disease, patients suffer a slow deterioration of the central nervous system, beginning with muscle weakness and poor coordination, and progressing to memory loss, mood and behavior changes, loss of higher cognitive functions, paralysis, vegetative state, and eventually coma and death. The deterioration is excruciatingly slow, taking 5 to 10 years, and as of now, there is no cure or even treatment to slow the progression. The patients and their loved ones are powerless, fully aware of the nature of the impending decline. The cause of Huntington's disease, like all genetic diseases, is a mutation in the genome. However, if a genetic disease persists instead of being eliminated by natural selection, there must be a reason, as we saw with sickle cell disease. This is especially true in the case of a genetically dominant condition like Huntington's, which has no carriers, only victims. Around 1 in every 10,000 people in Western and Northern Europe has the dominant and lethal Huntington's mutation, with the highest rates in Scandinavia and the British Isles. That may not sound like much, but it adds up to hundreds of thousands of people in these regions alone. Although the percentage of Huntington's mutations in Asian populations is much lower than it is in Europe, the total number of people who are affected by the disease is much higher, given how much more populous Asia is. This begs the question, how can Huntington's disease be so common if it is also so deadly? The answer is almost as cruel as Huntington's itself. By the time Huntington's strikes, the sufferer is past prime reproductive age, and so may have already passed the disease gene on. Rather than taking the disease allele with them when they die, the victims leave it behind with their offspring as a grim genetic legacy. The genetics behind Huntington's disease wasn't even discovered until the late 19th century. Before then, no one had any idea that it was passed on in such a simple manner. Of course, it seems obvious now, but the nature of Huntington's was partly obscured by the fact that, until the past 2 or 3 centuries, most people died before reaching age 40. The disease didn't track as cleanly in a family tree as it does now because people were dying of so many other afflictions and infections before they reached the ripe old age of 20 years. In addition, in earlier times, both women and men tended to begin their reproductive lives earlier than people in the developed world do now. When someone did live to be 40 years old, he or she was likely to be an aged grandparent, and a disease like Huntington's, with its slow start and non-specific early symptoms, was mistaken for dementia, or just old age. Because of its late onset, Huntington's can be passed on with natural selection having little to say about it. Selective forces can operate only on inherited traits that directly or indirectly affect reproduction or survival. That is, survival through reproductive age. Beyond that, one's genes have already been passed on to the next generation's gene pool. An affliction like Huntington's doesn't much affect the number of successful offspring one produces, so it is largely in natural selection's blind spot. Genetic diseases are shockingly common in the human population and are often deadly or debilitating. Most are inherited, and whether they have persisted for generations or are the result of a sporadic mutation, they all come down to errors in our DNA blueprints. Chromosomes break, DNA is mutated, and genes are destroyed. And evolution is sometimes powerless to stop it. As if that weren't bad enough, there is another onslaught that our genomes must endure. Viruses. Our viral graveyards. Just as it's populated with pointless pseudogenes and harmful disease genes, the human genome also contains the remnants